Meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order. The time is 3:17 p.m. on March 30th. Members present are Representative Carrick, Representative Cologne, Representative Freer, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Fields, and myself. Carolyn Hall, we have a quorum. Please silence cell phones. We're asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Joan Wilkerson, and she will take care of it. I'd like to thank Andrew Magnuson, the Labor and Commerce Committee Secretary, and Susan Quigley from the Juno LIO for tech and teleconferencing support. We have a very busy and full agenda today. We will be hearing six bills. Before we turn to the business of this committee, we will address a motion to discharge HB 147, Practice of Naturopathy, from this committee. Bills before committee must provide notice to the public. A bill for which the subject matter was not noticed may not be heard. It is a violation of Uniform Rule 23A, and if it passed, would violate the Open Meetings Act, which is AS.44.62.310. In addition, the March 27, 2026 House Labor and Commerce Committee schedule did not include bills previously heard or scheduled. Therefore, bringing a motion to move an unscheduled bill out of committee was out of order. This is the ruling of the chair. I rule the motion to move out of committee HB 147, Practice of Naturopathy, was out of order and is denied. Okay. The interruption created by the March 27th motion denied two other legislators the opportunity to present their bills as scheduled. This must be remedied and will be remedied on Wednesday. HB 285 and SB 211 will be heard as first items on the agenda on Wednesday, April 1st, and the remaining bills will be reordered. We will now move on to our first hearing on HB 316, Adjust Damage Limit, Personal Injury, Wrongful Death. Representative Gray is the sponsor. Representative Gray and your aide, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, please come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your presentation. Welcome to Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hall, and thank you for hearing House Bill 316. As Chair of the House Judiciary Committee, I'm frequently involved in conversations about how to better serve victims of crime and ensure they receive adequate compensation and restitution for the harm they have suffered. But we often forget about the role that the civil justice system plays in ensuring just compensation for victims. Non-economic damages compensate civil litigants for intangible harms such as pain, suffering, and emotional distress. These damages are determined by a judge or jury based on the evidence presented. But the jury does not have the final word. By statute, non-economic damages are capped, regardless of what a jury believes is fair. When the legislature enacted these caps in 1997, its stated purpose was to, quote, encourage the efficiency of the civil justice system by discouraging frivolous litigation and by decreasing the amount, cost, and complexity of litigation without diminishing the protection of innocent Alaskans' rights to reasonable but not excessive compensation for torturous injuries caused by others, end quote. In short, the legislature sought balance, protecting defendants from runaway verdicts while ensuring injured Alaskans could still recover meaningful compensation. That balance has since been lost. Inflation has dramatically eroded the real value of Alaska's damage caps. In terms of purchasing power, the caps today are worth barely half of what the legislature intended when they were set in 1997. The caps have not been moved. The cost of living has. The result is that innocent Alaskans are receiving compensation that, in real terms, is a fraction of what the legislature deemed reasonable 30 years ago. HB 316 does not seek to expand or rewrite Alaska's damage caps. It simply preserves them. By adding an inflation adjustment mechanism to existing statute, the bill ensures that the compensation available to injured Alaskans keeps pace with the actual cost of living, nothing more. This is the straightforward fix needed to honor the legislature's original intent. Reasonable, but not excessive, compensation for those harmed by the wrongful conduct of others. By not adjusting the non-economic damage caps for inflation over the last 30 years, we have severely eroded the ability of victims to recover damages for things like pain, suffering, and emotional harm. The purpose of this bill is to correct this oversight and protect the rights of victims. I will now turn it over to my staff, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, to walk through the specifics of the bill and answer any questions the committee may have.
For the record, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, staff to Representative Gray, Co-Chair Hall, Co-Chair Fields, and the members of the committee. Thanks for having us here today. So Structurally, this is quite a simple bill. It creates an inflation adjustment mechanism in Alaska Statute 917.010 and provides that the existing damages caps are to be adjusted according to that inflation adjustment mechanism. And that's really all it is mechanically. Happy to answer any technical questions from the committee. I know we have, I think, some invited testimony online.
Yes, I'm thinking we should go direct into invited testimony because we are so short on time, and I want the committee to be aware that we will be limiting the amount of questions that are going to be asked because our agenda is so packed. So with that, Representative Gray, do you prefer starting with Mr. Scala or Dr. Colt?
Scala.
Okay. Jason Scala, I see that you are online. Will you please put yourself on the record and begin your invited testimony?
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 316. For the record, my name is Jason Scala. I'm a private civil trial attorney in Anchorage, Alaska, but my primary focus is on representing clients both in Anchorage, but I do a lot of, I both live and spend a lot of time litigating on the western Arctic slope of Alaska. When this was first presented, it immediately triggered that this is really an issue about access to justice. As I give this talk, I'm going to say that there's a disparate impact in rural communities. I gave some handouts in front of judiciary, and I believe those are available through Representative Gray's office. But what I wanted to talk about is that because of the failure for one part of the legislation to index, what we found is that the only thing that's depreciated in value since 1997 is the cost or the value of an injured Alaskan or a dead Alaskan's life. And the reason this happens is that this was enacted as a part of a package of legislation. And Civil Rule 82, Alaska Rule of Civil Procedure 82, is what's sometimes commonly called the English rule, but that's a partial fee shifting to the prevailing party in litigation. So if two parties go to court, the prevailing party is going to be awarded part of its attorney's fees. So that is inherently indexed to the cost of living increase because every year the cost of defending yourself or retaining a lawyer goes up, and so it's baked into the statute. The problem is there isn't, in the absence of this amendment, and really what it is, it's a tweak. There's not parity where one side increases over time and the other does not. In fact, what you find is a widening gulf between Rule 82, which is a penalty to discourage frivolous litigation. That risk and the cost of that risk goes up every year, whereas the potential reward to an injured plaintiff goes down because it has an increase. It's the same $400,000 or million that it would have been. I think as a preliminary matter, our Supreme Court has dealt with this almost since its enactment. I think the best case to look at, if you want to see the court's position, is Evans X. Rel. Kutch v. State. That's 56 P. 3rd, 1046, and that's Alaska 2002. The two important takeaways is it was very clear this is absolutely a constitutional law, and it is the responsibility and the exclusive purview of the legislature. But they said in there that this is not a judicial fix. It has to be a legislative fix, and it seems like our court for the last, 26 years has anticipated that at some point the tweak would have to come legislatively because it is correctly a legislative responsibility, not a judicial one. So, and again, the charts that I would refer to from previous testimony, if you look at the cost of a case, and I just took a 200-hour case going to trial, well, that's very charitable that it would go to trial in 200 hours. If you were look at the billing, which back then the average wait was $145 an hour, that has increased 132% presently. So that we're now looking, a 200-hour case would have had total billed fees of $29,000 in 1997. In 2026, that's $67,200. So the downside risk to someone going to court in 1997 was $8,700. Today, it's they're looking at, if there was a 30% award given, $20,160. And you have to contrast that with the diminishing purchasing power of the $400,000 cap. And that $400,000 cap is for all wrongful death and any injury that does not constitute severe disfigurement or disability. So again, I have a chart where we compare the cost of everyday household items, but in looking at these, I would strongly suggest that you consider the disparity between urban communities and rural communities. For instance, a gallon of milk may be $7 in Anchorage, $6 to $7, but it can be as high as $15 on the Western Arctic Slope. And so what you see is an unintentional disparate impact, because rural prices have actually gone up far faster than urban prices in everything but housing. A new car in 97 was $23,500. Average now is $49,000 in Anchorage, $55,000 because you have to ship it to the bush. And you can go through everything that you would buy, with the exception of home prices. It's higher in rural Alaska. Now, the other added kind of unintended consequence here is that the cost of obtaining justice for a client goes up every year. In the kind of cases we're contemplating, you have expert witness testimony. They tend to be expert heavy. Every year, the cost of retained experts goes up, but those are not defined as recoverable litigation costs. So that cost is borne by the client if they lose, plus their Rule 82 penalty. So you're now looking at someone with $20,000 in experts and $22,000 in potential legal fees, contemplating whether or not they want to proceed with their case. And in advising a client, you have to tell them whether the juice is worth the squeeze. And every year that gap widens, and the number of people I counsel to pursue it, especially the working poor and middle class families, because there's always the trite response, well, you can discharge it in bankruptcy. Assuming that you own a home and you can do that, it is dischargeable, but now you've ruined your credit. The other aspect that we don't talk about is that those, and these are non-economic damages we're talking about, which usually you think about it, if dad was there, dad could work, dad could pay for college, dad could pay for groceries. Dad isn't there anymore, so what is there for the family to do with the remaining non-economic damages? Pay for those things that we all would anticipate if he'd lived, he could pay for. So the problem we have here is that we're creating a disparate impact on the Alaskan taxpayer, because to the extent that these folks are not fully compensated in a civil trial, as contemplated back in 1997, this should have been sufficient to cover those costs. Those costs are now borne by enrollment in government services. And so the pass-through isn't always just to the individual Alaskan who's a litigant, but it's passed on an increased cost in services to all of us when they're insufficiently compensated by a civil award. So I would suggest that those are the primary drivers here on an access to justice contemplation. And I would underscore that although this adjusts the potential recovery, at no point does this contemplate increasing the minimum insurance. And I know always one of the concerns is going to be, well, what effect will this have on our insurance rates? The amount being insured does not go up with the statutory minimums for Alaska. That's a wholly separate legislative endeavor, which you guys can contemplate when and if you need to. But in the context of reforming the law, it was contemplated that this would work in conjunction, where half of it is increasing and half of it is static. So every year this goes unaddressed is one more year the gulf between the cost of litigation and the potential reward, that gap widens. And that was not intended to happen. It does not increase the amounts that were contemplated as reasonable at the time of enactment. And it simply brings the law into parity, which our court has talked about since 2002 and as recently as 2025. The effect is not disputed, but the solution has to come from the legislature. And to the extent I have any more time, I know you're in a hurry, I would yield it for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Scala. We're going to move forward with our agenda. We're going to hear from Dr. Stephen Colt with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Dr. Colt, would you please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony? And Mr. Colt, if you were speaking, you're muted.
I'm here. There's a little bit of a delay with Teams, so I think I'm here.
You are.
And all right. Co-chair and member of the committee, my name is Steve Colt. I am a professional economist. I've been working in Alaska since 1984, and I spent most of my career here at the university, where I currently have a part-time appointment. Especially in interest of full disclosure, I do also work part-time as an expert witness on economic damages, and I am routinely hired by both plaintiffs and defendants. I have submitted written testimony, and I will may skip over some of the sentences in the write-up in the interest of time, but basically I'm going to give you what's in my written testimony. So many of us may recall or have read about Elmer Rasmussen characterizing inflation as a thief in the night, something that slowly but surely reduces the purchasing power of any fixed dollar amount. And as a result, today the Alaska price level is almost two times what it was in 1997, and therefore the current cap of $400,000 on non-economic damages has the same purchasing power as if the legislature in 1997 had set a cap at $212,000. Now, the legislature has long recognized this problem of the thief in the night, and indeed, inflation adjustment pervades our statutes. Co-chair Fields himself or his staff produced a list of more than 20 examples back in 2019 of where Alaska statutes require or provide for inflation adjustment. So given this context, I just want to bring to your attention what I think are two reasons why this bill makes good economic sense. First, HB 316 honors the will of the legislature as expressed back in 1997. A dollar of compensation is only as good as what it can buy, and lawmakers in 1997 surely had in mind what $400,000 or $1 million could buy at that time. Second, this bill restores and maintains a rough parity between economic and non-economic damages. So Mr. Scala talked about parity, and I'm now going to talk about what I think is a slightly different a version or form of parity. So why do we need to restore a rough parity between economic and non-economic damages? Well, it's because economic damages relate primarily to the loss of the ability to earn money, and the ability to earn money does tend to keep up with or even surpass inflation over time. Therefore, economic damages do keep up with inflation on their own. Also, and this may be somewhat of a subtle point, but in my experience, it seems to be an important one, and that is economic damages are higher for high-income injured people. In fact, a low-income decedent in a wrongful death action may very well generate low or even zero economic damages. So, of course, it's your policy call. But in my opinion, non-economic damages are a reasonable way of compensating injured parties for something other than simply a loss of monetary earning power. And therefore, parity between non-economic and economic damages seems to me to be an expression of fairness and respect toward injured people regardless of their money earning power. So to sum up, HB 316 honors the intent of the 1997 legislature. It is consistent with widespread inflation adjustments in current Alaska law, and it maintains parity between economic and non-economic damages. So for these reasons, I think this bill merits your thoughtful consideration. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Dr. Colt. Dr. Colt, we have a question from Representative Sadler.
Actually, first my question is to you, Madam Chair. You said at the beginning that you're going to, in the interest of time, limit questions. I just wonder, is that number of questions or time, and if you're also going to be limiting testimony, if so, how?
It is to be determined. As far as how many, I'm going to play it by ear with the time that we have scheduled. We have approximately 8 minutes left on this bill. Co-Chair Fields.
I had a question for Mr. Scala, if he's still online.
Mr. Scala?
Yes, I'm here.
Through the chair, I think...
I am here.
Hi, Mr. Scala. Through the chair, I think your office in Anchorage downtown in my district was affected by a fire, and I was just hoping for an update on that, and you can get back to me directly if we don't want to use committee time. Thank you.
Co-chair Fields, I don't want to use committee time on this, so if you could please connect offline, that would be appreciated. Representative Colon.
I have a question for this bill sponsor. Is that the right time to do that?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so if I just want to make sure I understand what Section 3 is doing. So if it's in statutes, it's saying to be adjusted for inflation using 100% of the change. So has that happened one time, or is that the wording that it's continually being inflation-proofed every year?
Thank you for the question, Representative Colom. I will turn over to my staff, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez.
For the record, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez, through the chair, co-chairs to Representative Colom. Yes, the idea is that this would be an ongoing inflation adjustment mechanism. Okay. And I think that, you know, the sponsor would be open to if there's some tweaks there for how that is administered. I know that we have other places in Alaska statute where it's effective the first of the year, that is an option as well. But the idea would be that at least I think the closest analog perhaps would be, or there's many of them, but the Alaska Minimum Wage Act, which requires the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to update and publish that, at the first of the year. So the reasoning for the Consumer Price Index here is because we already have that data. We're already using it in other places. And so we can, however mechanically to do that, to make sure it's an ongoing inflation adjustment mechanism is the intent of the bill.
Okay, follow up.
Yeah,
I'm just looking. I hadn't seen the 100% of the change from 97. I've seen a lot of CPI language in different legislation, but I was just wondering why that 100%. I can see needing that to bring it up to today, but we're doing it 100% every year.
And that may well be a question for Legislative Legal Services, because they were the ones who looked at all the various different inflation adjustment mechanisms and refined it to this. So, again, some tweaking. I do think AS 2310-065, which is the minimum wage statute, also uses 100% of the rate of inflation.
Okay.
So I think that would be the goal there.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to note for the committee as well that we do have Nancy Mead in the audience with the Alaska court system. She's available to help answer questions. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. The sponsor statement, Mr. Scala, Dr. Colt, I'll say that this bill would honor the original intent of the legislature in this tort reform bill. I wonder if anyone can point me to explicit language that was the intent, or is this simply an assumption that inflation should be a factor? I did hear Dr. Colt say there are 20 places in all Alaska statutes where there's inflation. I don't know if that constitutes pervasive. So what basis to assert that this is the original will of the legislature?
Thank you. I will refer to my staff, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez.
For the record, Dylan Hitchcock-Lopez, staff to Representative Gray, through the co-chairs. So it was House Bill 58. That's Chapter 26, SLA, 1997. Section 1 of that is the position statement, the legislative intent, when Representative Gray quoted from that as part of his opening remarks. But to reiterate again, they are, quote, and this is from the position statement from that piece of legislation which enacted these caps, quote, to encourage the efficiency of the civil justice system by discouraging frivolous litigation and by decreasing the amount, cost, and complexity of litigation without diminishing the protection of innocent Alaskans' right to reasonable but not excessive compensation for tortious injuries caused by others, close quote.
I won't debate, but thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. I want to thank the sponsor for bringing this forward, because I had a constituent ask me to introduce this bill, and I just did not have the capacity. So I'm really glad to see it's coming forward. I think the question is for one of our invited testifiers. I know if someone chooses not to pursue a claim, it's hard to quantify, you know, how many people may have been impacted who did not file a claim. But I'm just curious about if we know the number of cases from, say, through this time period since this was enacted in 1997 to now. I think you had mentioned that they have gone down, but do we have anything a little more concrete than that? Probably for the professor.
Dr. Colt, do you want to take a first stab at that question?
I can give it a try. Through the chair, Representative, I cannot answer directly how many cases do not get pursued, but what I can say, just a thought popped into my head, that in my experience as an expert, the vast majority of cases settle. And so a parameter such as these caps is going to be working in the process of settling those cases. And it's going to the extent the cap is lower, it's going to tend to drive down the settlement outcomes. So I think that might be something that you could consider. That's maybe that's the best I can do to try to address the concern in your question. Thank you.
Okay. Are there additional questions for the bill's sponsor, Representative Cologne?
Thank you, Chair. I did notice that there is a strongly worded letter from the insurance. It's not an agency, it's a group, warning about this could increase insurance rate. Just want to give you an opportunity to respond to that.
Thank you for the question. Dylan Hitchcock Lopez, staff to Representative Gray. I did see that letter as well. It looks like a sort of conglomerate of out-of-state insurance companies. One thing I would note apropos of that question is that based on my research, only nine states cap non-economic damages in personal injury and wrongful death cases, and at least two of those already have inflation adjustment mechanisms built into those. So to the extent that there's sort of a parade of horribles from the insurance companies, I would hazard a guess that the fact that California and New York and Texas, I believe, don't have caps, probably has more of an impact on the nationwide mutual insurance industry than the state of Alaska's cap in this statute.
Yeah, follow-up?
Follow-up.
That was my impression when I read the letter, but then I saw a fiscal note from the Department of Risk Management, and they were warning about the same kind of thing. So I'm just trying to figure out how much – I'm not saying I wouldn't vote for the bill. I'd like to know how it would – it does seem like it could raise rates. Fair?
Through the chairs, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez again, staff to Representative Gray. I mean, I also saw that fiscal note, and I did request some data from the Division of Risk Management. I don't want to speak at length to their fiscal note. I don't think I'm the proper witness for it. But one thing I did notice is that even looking kind of at a quick glance at their numbers going back to the start of 2025, there were only three or four cases where the total amount, claim amount, was more than $400,000, was more than the cap here. And that was both for non-economic and economic damages. And so one of the things that I do think that we need to think about, and maybe a question for them at a later hearing, but it's just, I think this is a somewhat difficult thing to quantify in terms of where we're kind of talking about unknowns. And so not to retreat to a philosophical point, but I do think that this was the balance that the legislature set in 1997. And at that time, they thought this was the appropriate balance between keeping insurance rates down. And so I would just say that it does seem that if, to the extent that premiums have gone down, I know that that's a concern, but that is maybe shifting the burden through the course of inflation onto actual Alaskans who have been harmed. That looks to me like a little bit more of a windfall to those insurance companies than it is an actual calculated intent of this body.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Klum. With that, thank you very much, Representative Gray and Mr. Hitchcock Lopez, for being here. We will put this bill aside for the time being. We look forward to hearing it again as soon as we're able. The second bill is a first hearing on HB 211, Insurance Prepaid Legal Plan, sponsored by Representative Jimmy. Not seeing Representative Jimmy in the room, but we do have her aide, Keenan Miller. So, Mr. Miller, please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Hello, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Keenan Miller. I'm staff to Representative Jimmy. I'm going to be presenting today on her behalf. I'm going to get right into things. So House Bill 211 is an act relating to prepaid legal plans. This bill does two things. Number one, it exempts prepaid legal plans from regulation as insurance products. And number two, it specifies consumer protections related to prepaid legal plans. As you may know, it's really hard to get justice in Alaska. Lawyers are expensive, and they don't always live in rural areas. We know that more than half of Alaskans that go looking for legal help from the Alaska Legal Services Corporation looking for pro bono legal aid are turned away. We know that the hourly rate for a lawyer can cost more than 4 months of the cost of a prepaid legal plan. And we know that these are a low-cost option that you know, lets people pay a monthly or annual fee for access to legal help and encourages a kind of more preventative approach. Right now, these plans are regulated as insurance, but they're kind of more a subscription service. They've been on the market for about 50 years now and have a decent reputation, a good reputation, I should say. And again, they can encourage people to get legal help and legal advice before a small legal problem becomes a really big one, which is the main benefit. If we put HB 211 into law, Alaskans will still be protected from unethical actors in the legal system through two mechanisms. One, the Alaska Bar Association will still have jurisdiction over potential badly behaved lawyers. And number two, the Consumer Protection Unit will still have jurisdiction over potential bad behavior from businesses. We have one invited testifier on the line, and then we have Director Heather Carpenter with the Division of Insurance available for questions. I'm also available. Thank you,
Mr. Miller. Julia Jensen, Chief Legal Officer with Legal Shield. If you can hear us, please put your name on the record and introduce yourself and begin your invited testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair. My name is Julia Jensen. I am the Chief Legal Officer of Legal Shield. Although Legal Shield is a for-profit company, we are highly mission-driven. And so one of our core obligations, we feel, is to address the justice gap, where legal aid is income-restricted, leaving a lot of Alaskans who earn above the poverty threshold ineligible for help. And as Representative Jimmy stated, private attorney's bills are $350 an hour or more, which is out of reach for most families. And so there's this middle group of people who have real legal needs, who are too wealthy for free aid, but too cash-strapped for a private attorney. And that's where our product fits in. And so for as cheap as $30, $40, $60 a month, depending on the legal plan, members pay a monthly fee. Sometimes it could be changed to annual. And in exchange, they have access to Alaska-qualified attorneys to answer questions. So always free consultations, free letter, free document review. And then we also provide will review and help with traffic matters. And so we not only make it affordable, but it is a brand that Alaskans, if they're remotely located, they can also trust that they know who they're going to be getting legal help from.
Thank you, Ms. Jensen. We have a question from Co-Chair Fields.
Thank you. A question for the bill sponsor, I think. Is there anything in the current bill that allows individuals to cancel and stop paying at any time? I think when you look at subscription plans writ large, one of the more common areas of abuse is companies entrap people in long subscriptions they didn't intend to enroll in. And that would be one area where I would want to make sure we're not inadvertently enabling that.
Thank you, Representative Fields, or Co-Chair Fields, excuse me, Keenan Miller for the record. I'm not sure. I would have to get back to you for a 100% answer, but the Section 3 of the bill adds a list of explicit legal protections, and in addition to these explicit protections, every protection provided already by statute related to the Consumer Protection Unit would still apply. So if there's something
can I ask the question of Ms. Mead, possibly?
Yes. Ms. Mead, are you available to help perhaps answer this question?
I don't know the answer.
No? Okay. No, no problem at all. Or Ms. Jensen?
Yes. If I could answer Co-Chair Field's question, yes, all of our plans are cancelable at any time. And so if somebody's on a monthly plan, they can contact us and cancel without any fee.
Follow up? Through the chair, to the bill sponsor, I would just like to put that in statute that it is that consumers' rights to cancel at any time and not pay more than the month that they are in is protected in statute. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Ms. Jensen, are there any caps, either annual or lifetime, for the legal services that Life Shield provides to the people that subscribe to this legal service?
I apologize. I had difficulty hearing the question. Oh, certainly. Could you please repeat it?
Glad to repeat. Ms. Jensen, the question is, are there any annual or lifetime caps to the legal services that a subscriber can receive who participates in this kind of legal subscription offer?
Some of the, through the chair, some of the services, as explicitly written out in the legal plan, do have hourly caps. I shouldn't say hourly, a cap on how many hours can be provided. So, for instance, one of the benefits is civil defense, defense for civil litigation. And so the plan will specify you, the member has up to blank hour of pretrial hours and blank hour of trial hours. So that's not a lifetime cap, but it is a cap on hours. But for general advice, consultation, letter writing, limited document review, limited research, that is uncapped throughout the plan. And there could be other caps such as a free review of your will annually after it's been put in place. So, but all of the parameters of what is a covered legal service for your monthly fee and what is excluded are clearly delineated in the plan, and that is one of the requirements of Amendment Number 2 to HB 211 that was put into place under the Judiciary Committee.
Okay. So there are no lifetime caps?
Representative Sadler, we're going to turn to Representative Klum. She has a question.
I actually had a question for Director Carpenter from Division of Insurance.
Great.
Oh, she's here.
Thank you for being here, Ms. Carpenter.
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Director of the Division of Insurance.
So, thank you, Chair. This looks like, I guess I'm looking for some history because this bill is taking regulation, it's not being regulated like insurance anymore, even though sometimes they call it legal insurance. Do you know, like, why it's regulated as insurance and maybe any input on the impact of it not being regulated anymore?
Through the Chair, Representative, it has been regulated as insurance since this product started. I think it was around 2016. We had longstanding advice, the division, by our attorneys that it is an insurance product and needed to be regulated under Title 21. That was reviewed multiple years. Every few years, it seemed to come up as a question to the director, and our legal advice has not changed. So this bill would just exempt it from under Title 21. So right now, if there's any complaints about this product, they come to the division. If this bill were to pass, that would not be the case. And the amendment that was discussed does give more clear items under consumer protections. And any new complaints about this would go to the Department of Law instead of the Division of Insurance.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
Do you have, so does the division have regulations that you would have to eliminate, like around this specific product? Or is it just a complaint? The complaint goes somewhere different.
Through the chair, Representative, we wouldn't have to change any regulations for this. The product just wouldn't be filed with us anymore, so we wouldn't review it. So instead of us looking at filings from the company, we just wouldn't. And instead of any complaint coming to us, the process would be entirely different, and it would go to the Department of Law under their process. Or if there was a complaint about a specific attorney, that could go to the Bar Association.
Right. One more follow-up?
Follow-up.
So right now, does the division, like when you say it goes to you for review, are you reviewing like their price, their performance? Like what are the things that you look for when you review it?
Through the chair, Representative Klum, we would review to make sure they're following insurance statutes so that their product is filed correctly, that it is priced correctly, and that it is sound so they can pay claims, you know, or follow through, just like we would any other product Does that answer the question?
That answered my question. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Carpenter. Co-Chair Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. Since Ms. Carpenter is here, I was curious, in your view, is the consumer protection stronger or weaker in Division of Insurance versus the Department of Law? And if we were to shift it to the Department of Law, what other consumer protections should we think about that might not be in the current draft of the bill? Thank you.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Fields, I will just say I did do a look. I had my consumer services team review if we've received any complaints about Legal Shield. We have not. They are also the only company that has filed to offer this product in Alaska. So I can't say that they're better consumer protections with us. We're the only ones that review consumer complaints on insurance. Department of Law is carved out from reviewing those complaints. So by carving this out of statute, you would allow Department of Law to review it. It's just a different process. Not better or stronger, just different.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Through
the chair, I guess I don't have enough understanding when a human calls you or calls the Department of Law, who has better capacity to be responsive and handle that complaint, not just for Legal Shield, but I mean looking far into the future. Thank you.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Fields, for any insurance issues, I have about 5 employees that deal with complaints for all Alaskans, so it's not a huge group that's doing it. We're down a couple of people right now, so when I can hire, there'll be a few more that we'll have. I can't speak for the capacity at the Department of Law. That would have to be answered by Department of Law.
Follow up.
Could I just ask for that in a future hearing on this bill to try to gain a better understanding where there's more capacity? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Miller, for following through on Representative Fields' request. Next, we have Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Ms. Carpenter, I'm not quite clear. Is this kind of legal insurance being offered in Alaska currently? And if so, how many legal insurance policies are enforced in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it is being offered in Alaska. There should be some backup documents that you have, some information I provided to the sponsor and the Judiciary Committee about the history of this. So the product's been filed with us, I believe, since 2016, and we currently have about 1,113 policies in force in Alaska.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Okay. Representative Coulomb.
Thank you, Chair. So I have to remember. Maybe this is for the bill sponsor. I see that there's an amendment from the prior committee. Did that get adopted?
Through the chair to Representative Coulomb, yes, the amendment number 2 got adopted. Yeah. That was the one enumerating several different explicit consumer protections in addition to those that already exist by transitioning the jurisdiction of complaints from the Division of Insurance over to the Consumer Protection Unit.
Okay, great. Okay.
And Mr. Miller, could you speak more directly into the mic when you're
totally
on the record?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Additional questions from the committee for the bill sponsor or Ms. Jensen online or Ms. Carpenter?
I do brief.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Ms. Carpenter, is this kind of thing happening nationally? This kind of change from insurance to a different non-regulated service?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, insurance is regulated at the state level, so it depends on each state's insurance code. So we are one of the states that our attorneys and statutes have said, yes, this is an insurance product. Ms. Jensen could certainly speak to other states do not regulate it as insurance. It's just our code. If we want to carve it out, we need to be explicit.
If Ms. Jensen wants to take that, I wasn't asking for that.
Ms. Jensen, did you hear the question? If not, we can have Representative Sadler re-say it. Ms. Jensen, are you online?
I am.
Do you need?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now. Representative Sadler, will you please re-ask the question?
Very briefly, Ms. Jensen, just number of states that are making this change. How many states?
Yes. Through the chair. So currently, Alaska is one of only 5 states in the country that regulates a legal plan such as ours as insurance. And so there's some perhaps historical reasons why that's the case, but we have slowly been going to states, and so that's why it is only 5 that continue to treat it as an insurance product. Most importantly, it doesn't behave as insurance, where we pay a claim and there's some kind of transfer of risk. This is a monthly fee, and from that monthly fee, there are certain services that are available to the member.
Thank you, Ms. Jensen. Representative Cologne.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think I have a question for the bill sponsor. In your sponsor statement, it says that the bill removes a barrier for Alaskans that would use a prepaid legal plan. What I'm struggling with is this change from an insurance product to a subscription service. How is that? Where's the barrier? Like, why do we care if it's regulated by insurance? I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out. How is that a problem?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Cologne. So two things here. Number one is because right now a prepaid legal plan is treated as an insurance product, to sell it in the state, a salesperson would have to have an insurance credential, which drives up the cost of labor and in turn, you know, drives up the cost of the product.
Okay. Are there additional questions or comments from the committee? Okay. Seeing none. Thank you very much, Ms. Carpenter. Thank you, Mr. Miller, for being here. Thank you, Ms. Jensen, for your time. With that, we're going to set this bill aside for a future date. The third bill on our agenda today is a second hearing on HB 302, Travel Insurance, sponsored by my office. My aide, Keith Bruce, is going to come up to the table, put himself on the record, and remind the committee of what is in the bill. Thank you for being here, Mr. Bruce.
Thank you, Chairs Hall and Chair Fields and the Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Keith Bruce, staff to Representative Hall. With the Chair's permission, I will provide a brief summary of HB 302. 302, an act relating to travel insurance, replaces Alaska's outdated travel insurance statutes with a more comprehensive and nationally uniform model. Crafted by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners and the National Council of Insurance Legislators, the model reflected in HB 302 does three things for Alaska. First, it provides extensive and unambiguous protections for Alaskans buying travel insurance. These protections range from specific bans on opt-out practices to general transparency requirements and will allow Alaskans to feel confident in the travel insurance plans they purchase. Second, HB 302 creates clear rules and streamlined licensing for insurance sellers. These changes create a level playing field for insurance producers and will make Alaska a better place to do business. Third, this bill provides a nationally tested insurance framework with clear lines of authority, making the work of our state's insurance regulators easier. In short, the bill before you strikes a balance between the consumer, the insurance industry, and regulatory bodies, and will help grow Alaska's thriving travel and tourism sector. I believe we have travel insurance experts Karen Alvarado and Duke DeHaas online, as well as Division of Insurance Director Heather Carpenter in the room to answer any questions the committee might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. And we also noticed public testimony on this, so I'm going to open public testimony. Public testimony is open. Is there anybody in the room who would like to testify on HB 302? Seeing none, we will go online, and I believe Ms. Alvarado and Mr. DeHaas are here to also provide public testimony. So with that, we will start with Ms. Alvarado. Ms. Alvarado, will you please put yourself on the record, introduce yourself, and begin your testimony?
Apologies, I needed to get off of mute, so sorry.
Quite all right, please proceed.
So good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Karen Alvarado, for the record, and I am Vice President of Regulatory Affairs for Crum & Foster, a subsidiary of Fairfax Holdings. My organization has been writing travel insurance for many years and is fully licensed in all 50 states, including Alaska. And we are therefore very familiar with the unique intricacies of these products and the marketplace. I am also co-chair of the Law and Reg Committee for the U.S. Travel Insurance Association that is comprised of a variety of organizations involved in the travel insurance industry. I would like to thank the sponsors and the members for bringing this bill before the committee today and for allowing interested parties the opportunity to provide testimony in support of the travel bill. We are here in full support of the bill, which is important for travel consumers, state insurance regulators, and the industry. Travel insurance plays a critical role in protecting consumers from unforeseen events that can disrupt travel plans, such as medical emergencies, trip cancellations, lost luggage, or natural disasters. As travel has become more accessible and global, the risks associated with travel have also increased. Travel insurance provides peace of mind and financial security, ensuring that travelers are not left vulnerable to significant losses. This legislation is essential for safeguarding the interests of Alaska's residents and visitors, given the state's unique geographic and environmental challenges. In Alaska, where travel often involves remote destinations, unpredictable weather, and limited access to immediate medical care, these protections are especially important. Therefore, legislation that ensures clear policy language, fair claims handling, and transparent pricing will empower consumers to make informed decisions and travel with confidence. By enacting these robust travel insurance laws, Alaska can set standards for consumer rights and safety, ensuring that travelers are not left vulnerable to any financial hardships due to circumstances beyond their control. This not only benefits individual consumers, but supports the state's tourism industry by fostering trust and reliability. This legislation builds upon existing regulatory frameworks and further promotes a framework that works for everyone, regulators, consumers, and industry players alike. It promotes a clear and level playing field with minimal negative disruption while promoting uniformity throughout the state. The travel legislation is good for all participants because going forward, it provides specific requirements applicable to travel insurance with which all players will have to comply, including the new entrants to the growing market. The language you have before you has been thoroughly vetted to ensure that this legislation creates an efficient, effective regulatory framework for travel insurance that benefits everyone. The bill contains model language from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which is identical to a model act authored by the National Council of Insurance Legislators. To date, we are happy to report that as of last Monday, 42 states have enacted the Model Act so far, and we are hopeful that Alaska will be number 43. In addition, several other states are contemplating enacting similar language in their states during 2026 as well. As an industry leader, we support efforts to strengthen consumer confidence in travel insurance. We believe the clear regulations benefit the consumers and the reputable insurers by fostering a fair, competitive marketplace. Our company already adheres to best practices outlined in this legislation, and we are committed to working with regulators and lawmakers to ensure effective implementation. In closing, I urge the committee to support this bill, as this legislation will help protect travelers, promote transparency, and uphold the integrity of the travel industry. Thank you for your consideration. Please let me know if I can answer any questions or provide additional information.
Thank you, Ms. Alvarado. Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, we will move next in the queue to Duke DeHaas. Mr. DeHaas, are you here to provide public testimony this afternoon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to repeat testimony I provided 12 days ago. I appreciated the opportunity to appear before you. I'm Duke DeHaas, Deputy General Counsel at Allianz, also co-chair of the U.S. Travel Insurance Association Law and Rate Committee. Rather than go through my presentation again or read my testimony again, I'll be merciful unless asked and just wait for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeHaas. Okay. Looking online, that appears to be the end of anybody interested in providing public testimony on HB 302. I will ask the room again, is there anybody in the room who would like to provide public testimony on HB 302? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed. What is the will of the committee? Do committee members have questions for Ms. Alvarado, Mr. DeHaas, Mr. Bruce, myself, regarding HB 302?
I
have a question for Carpenter.
Sure, yes. Thank you for that reminder. We also have Miss Heather Carpenter here in the room as well. Thank you for joining us yet again, Miss Carpenter.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for being here and answering another question. So on page 7 of the bill, travel insurance, limited producers and retailers, it talks about the director issuing a travel insurance limited producer license to an individual or business entity that is filed with the director, an application in a form and manner prescribed by the director, and then it goes on from that. Is that what you guys do now? Is that a new thing that they, a new process that we're putting in to get people licensed as this new travel insurance limited producer?
For the record, Heather Carpenter, Director of the Division of Insurance, through the Chair, Representative Colomb. That is our process now.
Okay.
So earlier in the bill, we reference, I think it's Section 3, we have a list of who are the more limited lines instead of, you know, the main lines that are life and health, property and casualty, travel. You can get a limited license if all you're selling is travel. So we are updating that, and this language is very typical. So it, as our forms update or change, statute doesn't need to be updated. But I can tell you our licensing is mostly done online. There's very few people who are going to fill out a paper form.
Okay, so basically, follow-up?
Follow-up.
So basically, it's kind of what you're doing now. There's not, this isn't like added red tape for someone to sell travel insurance. It's kind of just, it's the basically the process you do now is in the bill.
Through the chair, Representative Colomb, correct. And it actually makes it a little bit easier because if you have a property and casualty insurance, now you can also sell travel without having to go and get that additional limited lines license if you're selling other products as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. I think this is probably for our invited testifiers. I heard that this is model legislation adopted nationally, and I'm just curious how many states have taken or some version of this legislation and enacted it?
Through the chair, thank you for the question. I think it's Representative Carrick. 42 states, as my co-chair mentioned, Washington's governor signed the legislation into law last Monday. So when I was there in Alaska, it was 41. We're now up to 42 that have enacted some version of the model. And most of them are, if not identical, I would say very few, if any, substantive deviations, maybe a few minor things here and there. And I can provide details if you want more specifics.
Just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you for that. And is there anything that would be Alaska-specific that maybe has... Is there anything that maybe we would need to do differently as a state with a lot of deviations in travel and a lot of changes in cancellations and things like that? Like, we are a heavy tourism state. We're a state that travels really heavily. Is there... this is the model legislation, but is there anything that would be worth considering for Alaska specifically? And that might also be a question for Ms. Carpenter, too.
Ms. Carpenter, do you want to start?
Sure. For the record, Heather Carpenter, Director of the Division of Insurance. I can tell you one specific place this has deviated from the model is the model was passed that it could be filed, the product could be filed on either the life and health line or the property and casualty line. And due to how we review products in the division, we needed to keep the model on the property and casualty side. That doesn't mean we can't have the products that they're filed right now on the life and health, but it's different and there's different benefits. So we are, you know, communicating with our partners who file that way to make sure they know they can still file their products. But in terms of all of what this has, like coverage for lost baggage and other items, it needed to be on the property and casualty side. But I do think I'm not seeing any other specific Alaska need that needs to be changed or called out. That doesn't mean I didn't miss something, but I'm not seeing it as of now.
I trust you. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Representative Kerr's question, first, how big a business is travel insurance in Alaska now, and are the rates here any higher or lower than the national average, say, to account for our special challenges as she listed?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I actually think our the invited testimony can talk about the rate for it's a very large industry, and I know there was some supportive documents from USTAA on how large the industry is, so I think they would be better suited to answer that. But I'm not seeing that our rates are significantly higher than other rates.
Ms. Alvarado, would you like to take a crack at answering that question?
Sure, happy to, through the chair. The Alaska travel insurance market is somewhere between $40 and $50 million currently. I don't believe that there is a significant difference in the rates than in any other state. All carriers file their forms and rates with the Department of Insurance, and they are approved as such. And the rates are usually consistent with and tied back to the different benefits that are being offered. So usually the rates will vary based upon the types of benefits that somebody is selecting in the plan and the trip that they wish to cover. But outside of that, there wouldn't be any significant difference.
Representative Sadler, this is your final question because we need to move on with our agenda. Representative
that.
Sadler.
The question was, I wanted to clarify, $40 to $50 million of insurance or travel? I wasn't sure what the units you were using there.
The travel insurance market.
Really? Wow. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Alvarado. And because we are up against time, I'm going to ask committee members if there are additional questions that you have to please contact my office or the Division of Insurance, and we will ensure that any questions that are asked, we share the answers and the questions to with the full committee. With that, we are going to hold this bill over and discuss it again at our next earliest opportunity. We're going to set an amendment deadline for HB 302, and that amendment deadline is April 1st, 2026 at 5 p.m. Thank you very much for being here. Okay. The fourth bill we're going to hear is the second hearing on HB 329, Electric Utility Certificate of Fitness. This is a Community and Regional Affairs Committee bill. It is being carried by Representative Mears and her staff, Griffin Plush. We heard this bill on March 25th and set an amendment deadline of March 27th at 6 p.m. We received one amendment, and the sponsor of that amendment is Representative Carrick. But before we turn to amendments, I would like to turn the floor to Representative Mears for a brief overview and reminder of what is included in this bill. After that, we will go to public testimony and go through the amendment process. Representative Mears, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us, Madam Chair. Representative Donna Mears from House District 21, South Muldoon. Mr. Plush will give us a quick summary.
Co-Chair Hall and members of the committee, for the record, this is Griffin Plush, staff to Representative Mears. This bill seeks to clarify statute in order to ensure that multi-community utilities like the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative can use local labor in the maintenance of their grids. It's clarifying the existing statutory exemption for certificate of fitness for utilities under 2,500 people.
Thank you very much for that brief update and reminder. With that, we will turn to public testimony. Public testimony is now open. Is there anybody in the room who'd like to provide public testimony on HB 329? Seeing none, I will turn to online. I see that we have a couple folks online, but one of the folks, Mr. Stamm, are you here to provide public testimony, or are you here to help answer questions?
I'm just here to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Stamm. And then Mr. Doug Tanzi with IBEW Local 1547. Mr. Tanzi, are you here to provide public testimony, or are you here to be available to help answer questions?
My understanding is I'm here to be available to answer questions.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Tanzi. With that, I don't see anybody else online to provide public testimony. With that, I will close public testimony. Okay, next, are there any questions at this point for the bill sponsor? If not, we will turn right into amendments. Seeing none, Representative Carrick, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number one.
Object.
Great. So amendment number one just clarifies what the invited testimony had talked about last week. and the bill sponsor's office as well. Qualified employees of a local, municipal, or tribal government performing work are listed, and I had just asked a question at our previous hearing about where liability falls if you have an employee of a municipal or tribal government in particular. And the testimony had said it would fall to the utility, and the utilities also, AVEX representative also mentioned that. So this amendment number one just clarifies that the electric utility bears the liability for work performed under this legislation.
All right. Representative Mears, would you like to speak to the amendment?
Thank you, through the chair. We ran this amendment by the folks online. It's just reinforcing practice, so I think it's just clarification and no objection.
Okay. Representative Fields, do you maintain your objection?
I do not.
Okay. Seeing no further objection, amendment number one is adopted. Are there any final thoughts or comments from the committee or questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion?
I move to report House Bill 329, Work Order 34-LS1412-I, out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Okay. Seeing no objection, HB 329, Work Order 34-LS1412-I is reported out of committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. With that, we're going to take a brief at ease to sign the committee paperwork. Okay, we are back on record. The fifth bill is a second hearing for HB 155, Alcohol Sales Local Option, sponsored by Representative Foster. His staff, Paul LaBolle, is here to provide a brief overview of the bill, and then we will take public testimony. Thank you for being here, Mr. LaBolle. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Paul LaBolle, staff to Representative Foster, House Bill 155. Creates a new local option for municipalities to choose from, one where the municipality would own the package store license, but the dispensary license and restaurant license would be left to private sector.
Very good. Do members of the committee have questions for Mr. LaBolle? We also have Kevin Richard online from the Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Mr. LaBolle, do you have any idea, or you're the sponsor, have any idea just how many municipalities this bill would apply to? It's a fairly specific change to statute. I just wondered how broad a reach it would have.
Thank you. So the total number of licenses or local options that are being exercised currently is 109. There are 23 that bound sale. There are 6 that the municipality exclusively holds the license for all types of sale. There are 4 that ban sale and importation, and there are 30 that ban sale, importation, and possession.
So,
one follow-up, Representative Sadler.
I'll make it a good one. It was actually my first question. How many was this going to affect? How many communities are likely to take advantage of this differentiation?
Thank you for the question. This is pure speculation, but my guess would be that only the current ones who are using the municipal license option would consider this. So you're looking at maybe 6. And then in terms of wet communities that might want to take advantage of this, I doubt there's very many out there. I would hazard to guess that only your regional hubs would consider it.
Thank you, Mr. LeBeau.
Thank you, Mr. LeBeau. With that, we are going to turn to public testimony. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony? Seeing none, and I am not seeing anybody online, I will close public testimony. Do committee members have any final questions for Mr. LeBeau? Okay.
Well, actually, yes.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. LeBeau. You mentioned 25, 6, 4, and the 30 was how many?
30 was for spanning sale, importation, and possession.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. With that, we previously heard this bill on March 23rd when an amendment deadline was set for March 26th at 5 p.m. No amendments were received. If it is the will of the committee, Mr. Co-Chair, may I have a motion?
I move to report House Bill 155, Work Order 34-LS0773-LA, out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Object. There's been an objection. Will the committee secretary please call the roll?
Representative Carrick.
Yes.
Representative Nelson is not present. Representative Colomb.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Freer.
No.
Co-Chair Fields.
Yes.
Co-Chair Hall.
Yes.
5 yea, 1 nay.
With a vote of 5 yea and 1 nay, House Bill 155, Work Order 34-LS0773-A is reported out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. With that, we will take a brief at ease to sign the committee paperwork. Okay, we are back on record. The 6th and final bill the committee will hear today is SB 89, Physician Assistant Scope of Practice, sponsored by Senator Tobin. Senator Tobin, thank you for being here, especially with your staff, Mackenzie Pope, as well. Thank you, Ms. Pope. Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. For the record, my name is Lukey Gail Tobin, and I have the pleasure and privilege of representing the neighbors who live in the communities that comprise North Anchorage.
Mackenzie Pope, staff to Senator Lukey Gail Tobin.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairwoman. We are elated to bring to you Senate Bill 89. Senate Bill 89, at its core, is about increasing access to quality preventative health care. And this bill has had an interesting journey to this point. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how we got to here and then about what's included in this legislation. About 4 years ago, I had a group of physician assistants come to my office and share with me that the state medical board had introduced new regulation that would effectively eliminate their profession from the state of Alaska. In talking with the state medical board, there was a lot of concern about this approach on reducing the administrative burden for physician assistants. And as we tried to work through the process, we kept finding roadblocks and challenges. Well, I am happy to say that through the efforts of the physician assistants that you will hear from today and many of our doctors in the medical community, we have come to what I think is a very elegant way to reduce the administrative burden that our physician assistants face here in Alaska. At its core, this bill is about providing more health care options for the people of Alaska. We want to ensure that people are able to get preventative appointments and, of course, experience reduced costs. The structure of this legislation seeks to do two things. The first is to reduce the financial administrative burdens our physician assistants face here in Alaska. The second is to codify the profession of physician assistants in state statutes so that the fear that those physician assistants felt 4 years ago will never be experienced again. As I mentioned, that Senate Bill 89 in its current form is the result of years of development and conversations in the medical community. One of the things I do want to note is that the legislation continues to have the strong oversight and guardrails by the State Medical Board for physician assistants, that physician assistants will continue to work in physician-led facilities. Those are outlined in the legislation, and you will hear them as we go through a sectional analysis. And, of course, that the collaborative agreement that physician assistants currently are required to hold today will still be required for any physician assistant who does not work at a physician-led facility. One of the things that really led me to being interested in this bill is the recognition that our physician assistants provide a unique service to us, and particularly in the communities that I grew up in rural Alaska. Many of the primary care providers in those areas are physician assistants. And ensuring that they are continue to provide care that is holistic and integrated is really important. This bill provides a pathway to do that by reducing the cost to providing that service. In previous testimony, we heard from physician assistants that in some facilities, their medical practice was paying collaborating physicians who don't even live in the state of Alaska upwards of $50,000 so that they could continue to provide care, those physician assistants could continue to provide care to the Alaskans in which they served. In the course of this legislation, we have watched as the number of collaborating physicians who live out of state increase from 12% to 18%. It is just not a sustainable model to continue in that practice, and this legislation hopefully will address that particular administrative and financial burden and provide a unique pathway. We are happy to provide a sectional analysis. We also have two folks who are online for invited testimony, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Ms. Pope, would you please proceed with the sectional analysis?
Yes. For the record, Mackenzie Pope, staff to Senator Lukey Gale Tobin. I'll try to be brief. Section 1 of SB 89 removes reference to a repealed statute. Section 2 repeals and reenacts the physician assistant or PA authorizing statutes. Subsection A allows PAs to provide medical care that they are qualified and competent to perform. Subsection B establishes that a PA is responsible for the care they provide. Subsection C maintains the existing collaborative agreement structure for PAs not practicing within the exempted locations laid out in subsection D. Subsection D outlines the locations a PA can practice at without a collaborative agreement. These locations include a facility directed by a physician, osteopath, or podiatrist, a healthcare facility licensed by the Department of Health, a tribal organization or federally operated healthcare facility, a federally qualified health center, or a military and veterans facility, among a few others. The State Medical Board can also authorize a PA at another location after a PA applies to the board for consideration. Section C describes specifications for qualifications for PA licensure. Section 4 directs the State Medical Board or its executive secretary to grant a license to qualified applicants. Section 5 includes physician assistants in the list of medical practitioners whose licensure we recognize from other states and provinces of Canada. Section 6 includes PAs in the existing temporary licensure process. Section 7 amends the existing statute to include PAs alongside other medical practitioners in the list of temporary licensure and substitute roles in different medical facilities. Section 8 adds a subsection to include PAs in the fee requirement when applying for a license. Section 9 includes the PAs in existing statute regarding the State Medical Board's parameters for evaluating any extenuating circumstances during licensure application. Section 10 includes PAs in the existing statutes regarding the process for being sanctioned for crime, misrepresentation, and failure to pay fees. Section 11 amends statute to include PAs in the existing voluntary surrender provisions. Section 12 includes PAs in the existing statutory process for reporting to the state medical board a fellow licensed medical practitioner who is being treated for alcoholism, drug addiction, and mental or emotional disorders who might constitute a danger to their patients or themselves to report that to the board, the state medical board. Section 13 grants immunity in civil liability for PAs who submit a report in good faith to the state medical board relating to addictive substances abuse. Section 14 amends statute so PAs cannot refuse to submit a report to the state medical board or withhold evidence on the grounds that the evidence is under doctor-patient confidentiality. Section 15 includes PAs with all other licensees in this chapter that if they practice without a valid license, they are guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. Section 16 amends the statute to include PAs in the list of medical providers who can support a licensed physician in another state in the support of the regular medical service of the U.S. Public Health Service or volunteering services to the armed service of the U.S. and other unique medical support situations. Section 17 allows physician assistants to show their PA credentials to communicate their qualifications. Section 18 includes PAs as providers who can accept concurrent referrals for systemic disease treatment. Section 19 amends the definition of practitioner to include physician assistant. Section 20 puts in statute the definition of physician assistant. Section 21 removes reference to a repealed statute. Section 22 adds a section to prevent any requirements within a healthcare insurance policy from being more restrictive than or inconsistent with the practice, education, or collaboration provisions outlined in this chapter of statute. Section 23 updates the definition of a licensed PA to remove supervision requirements, allowing for PAs who are working in a licensed facility to do so. And finally, Section 24 includes physician assistant in the definition of healthcare provider. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pope. With that, we will turn to invited testimony, and we will begin with Jenny Fayette with the Alaska Academy of Physician Assistants. Ms. Fayette, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
All right. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
All right. Good afternoon, Chairs Hall and Fields, and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Jenny Fayette. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, Alaska Academy of Physician Assistant Advocacy Chair, and a practicing physician assistant. I'm speaking in strong support of SB 89 and improving access to care across Alaska for our family and friends. As many of you on this committee are aware, this bill, as Senator Tobin stated, represents years of work to ensure that Alaskans, no matter how remote their community, can access timely, high-quality care, and that physician assistants are recognized and supported within our state's medical system. Most recently, our PA advocacy group and the Alaska State Medical Association formed a working group to find language that would benefit Alaska. After many meetings, we came forward with the current version of SB 89. It allows PAs practicing in physician-led practices, Department of Health, federal or tribal facilities, or federally qualified health centers to practice without the administrative burdens of our current regulations that were created in 1970s. This new amended SB 89 modernizes how PAs practice in Alaska. It codifies our profession and statutes. It simplifies our licensing. It defines our scope based on our education, training, and experience. It strengthens existing structures by maintaining oversight through the State Medical Board and supports strong collaboration with our physician partners, while also allowing the flexibility needed in real-world settings, especially in rural and underserved areas. This bill also protects access by preventing health insurance companies from being able to create barriers beyond our state laws, because when they do, it's the patients that pay. In Alaska, access to care isn't just important. It can be the difference between getting help and going without. I've cared for patients who have waited too long, traveled too far, or simply didn't have any other options. And I've also seen what happens when a PA is there, when care is timely, local, and life-changing. This work is deeply important to Alaska, and this bill allows us to do better. I respectfully ask for your support of SB 89 to protect access to care and strengthen Alaska's healthcare team. I'm available for any questions. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Fayette. We have a question from Co-Chair Fields.
Through the chair, just a statement. I appreciate Ms. Fayette and the physicians who collaborated for a year, basically, on a very extensive stakeholder working group. And I think the bill reaches the same intent now, but is very well crafted. And I really appreciate all the time that went into that.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Ms. Fayette, if you have your comments written down, I'd appreciate if you might send it in the committee so we could read them at our leisure and reference them, please.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Through the chair. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Fayette. Next, for invited testimony, we will go to Mary Swain, who's the Executive Director of Chamai Community Health Center. Ms. Swain, thank you for being here. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Field and Hall, and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Mary Swain, and I serve as the CEO of Chamai Community Health Center in Bristol Bay Borough. We are a federally qualified health center, also known as an FQHC, or community health center, serving a highly rural and geographically isolated region in Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of SB 89. I have done so many times. To provide some context, FQHCs are federally designated safety net providers responsible for delivering comprehensive primary care, behavioral health, school-based, and substance use services in underserved areas. In Alaska, there are 29 FQHC organizations with over 190 patient sites, and we serve more than 112 patients annually in Alaska. We are essential access points, particularly in communities where there are no other options. Like many rural clinics, Chamai is not just a primary care site. We also function as a community's emergent and urgent care provider. That means we are responsible for maintaining 24/7 coverage for clinical needs. There is no redundancy in our system. When we don't have a provider available, there is not an alternative down the street. While Alaska has a very strong tribal health system, not all rural providers are part of that exceptional system. Chamai operates independently. However, we partner closely with our regional tribal organizations to ensure continuity of care. That distinction matters because our regulatory and operational realities can differ, even though we are serving the same communities. From Chamai's perspective, SB 89 is important because it recognizes that many of us already operate within structured, physician-led collaborative care models that ensure quality and accountability. Additional state-layered requirements, when duplicative in those existing frameworks, do not improve care. They introduce delays into a system that cannot absorb them any longer. When I say duplicative, I want to give a concrete example. Under current state requirements, we must have two physicians sign the collaborative practice agreement. One is our medical director, who is actively involved in our clinic and our patients. The second is a physician who has historical connection with our organization but does not actively see our patients. We must compensate that physician for his role, even though our providers are already collaborating continuously with team-based care, in a team-based care environment. Their role is to serve as an additional collaborator on paper but may never be in contact with the PAs he is on the paper for. That requirement adds cost without improving care, and it illustrates how the current structure can be misaligned with how care is delivered. SB 89 removes this unnecessary requirement, eliminating added cost and administrative burden while maintaining appropriate clinical oversight through existing team-based structures. In rural Alaska, delays have very real consequences. Recruiting a provider is already a long process. It is not uncommon for it to take 2 to 3, even 4 to 5 months to fully credential a provider before they can practice in our setting. When additional administrative steps are required, particularly those needed to be completed before credentialing can even begin, such as a collaborative plan being approved by the state, it extends that timeline further. We have experienced situations where administrative disruptions to collaborative plans directly affected a provider's ability to see patients. When that happens, it is not just a paperwork issue. It means a provider is unable to provide care and continue their rotation. And we are unable to backfill that coverage quickly because of the time required to reestablish those approvals on those needed approvals in Alaska. In a 24/7 coverage model, That kind of disruption is significant. It impacts scheduling, continuity, and ultimately patient access. SB 89 helps address this by reducing unnecessary administrative burdens and aligns statute with how team-based care is already delivered safely in a setting like ours. I also want to specifically acknowledge the inclusion of the physician assistants in sections of the bill where they were previously absent. PAs are foundational to rural health care delivery, ensuring they are appropriately recognized in statute, supports workforce stability, and allows clinics like mine to maintain consistent coverage. From a labor and commerce perspective, this bill is about creating a more functional workforce environment. It reduces friction in hiring and onboarding, avoids duplicative regulatory structures, and supports the efficient deployment of qualified providers. For rural Alaska, that efficiently directly translates to access. HMI access means having a provider available when somebody walks through our doors, whether that's for primary care, behavioral health, or an emergency at 2 o'clock in the morning. Senate Bill 89 moves us closer to that system, and that supports the reality we strongly support. Thank you for your time and consideration, and if you have any questions, I'm open to hear them.
Thank you, Ms. Swain. Do committee members have questions for Ms. Swain? I am seeing none. Thank you for your time and for being here. With that, does the committee have any questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Carrick.
Thank you through the co-chair to Senator Tobin. Thanks for bringing this bill back forward. Are there any substantive changes in this bill from the version that was introduced in the previous legislature? And can you kind of speak to the specific differences between the two bills?
For the record, Mackenzie Pope, staff to Senator Tobin. Yes, the intent remained the same, but the structure and the kind of the compromise that the stakeholders found and struck, it moved away from the national model of the other states that have modernized their PA statutes. They have identified a set number of hours and to eventually exit a collaborative agreement. The stakeholders came back to the table and realized the piece in Alaska that needed to change to maintain patient safety but also allow PAs to work to the highest extent of their education is using our existing licensure process, including through facilities licensed with DOH. So the structure of the bill changed, but the intent and all of the ancillary parts stayed the same. So you'll see that kind of you won't see a mention of hours in this iteration of the bill, but all of the answers about safety and PA qualifications remain the same.
Yeah. Representative Colomb.
Thank you, Chair. I just was curious on page one, the change there is talking about the state medical board, and it looks like in statute it does say one physician assistant license in the state. Is there a reason why you put in the state and took out the statute?
That, I think, was just by for the record, through the chair, Mackenzie Pope, staff to Senator Tobin. They're removing reference to the existing PA statute, and the PA, one PA will still remain on the state medical board. It was just removing reference to that statute that's repealed and reenacted.
Okay.
And so I think it was a conforming change.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Additional questions from the committee? Seeing and hearing none, thank you very much, Senator Tobin and Ms. Pope, for being here. Thank you to the invited testifiers. Hearing no further questions, we will set an amendment deadline of March 31st at 3 p.m. for this bill. We will hold this bill over and hear it again on Wednesday. Representative Sadler.
I just want to clarify, so that's tomorrow at 3 p.m.?
Correct. That concludes our business for today. The House Labor and Commerce Committee will meet next on Wednesday, April 1st at 3:15 p.m. We are adjourned.